This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up, environmental activists take to the high seas in protest against deep-sea mining. Pacific nations welcome a new loss and damage fund, but say more is needed to reduce carbon emissions. And a renewed call for a visa-free Pacific. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, Australia and Papua New Guinea have signed a sweeping security agreement which commits both nations to deeper information sharing and holding joint consultations in the face of any security threats. The security pact is legally binding and has treaty-like status, although it's officially described as a framework for closer security relations. The agreement was signed by Prime Ministers Anthony Albanese and James Marape in Canberra earlier in the week. The text includes a provision which says if either country believes it's facing a direct or regional security threat, then both sides will consult and coordinate a response. Here's how both leaders described it, starting with Mr. Albanese.
This is a comprehensive and a historic agreement. It will make it easier for Australia to help PNG address its internal security needs and for Australia and Papua New Guinea to support each other's security and the region's stability. Policing and domestic security are priorities for my friend Prime Minister Marape. They are essential for the economic development of PNG and for the welfare of the people of that great nation.
We have now signed what is a historic bilateral security agreement that not only look into one spectrum of security but encompasses quite a broad spectrum of security that covers not just police, but looks into judiciary, has a working relationship with our defence, also look into the economic security of our people, as well as every other aspects that deals with our national prosperity and our national well-being.
PNG Prime Minister James Marape there. A first-of-its-kind protest against deep-sea mining in international waters has ended with activists ordered to abandon an exploration vessel. The company conducting mining exploration says the activists were being reckless and getting in the way of important scientific work. But the protesters say the court ruling was a massive own goal for the mining company. Marion Farr explains.
Way out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, far from land, a heated disagreement broke out.
We had five climbers who scaled the crane at the back of their ship.
And then eventually they boarded the vessel and sat on top of our A-frame, which meant that we couldn't safely operate it. So it brought the science to a grinding halt.
At that point, when we had an ongoing occupation, which was the first ever occupation of a deep sea mining industry ship at sea,
we were left with no option but to go to the courts to seek an injunction on their reckless behaviour.
Greenpeace activists were protesting against deep sea mining exploration in the Clarion-Clipperton zone.
It is continental in size, and it is the area that this new dangerous industry, deep sea mining, wants to get its monster machines into kilometres below the surface of the waves.
Louisa Casson is one of the protesters.
So far, this industry has always tried to operate out of sight, out of mind. And that's why we have deployed one of our Greenpeace ships to come out here to bear witness to what the metals company was doing.
The metals company is a Canadian resource group that has been leading the push towards mining the deepest parts of the ocean. They want to extract small rocks known as polymetallic nodules, which contain precious metals like copper, cobalt, and nickel. At this stage, the practice has not been approved on a commercial scale, but the metals company CEO, Gerard Barron, wants that to change. His company is pushing ahead with the backing of the Nauru government.
You know, our plan is still to be in commercial production pending the approval to do so by the end of 2025.
But in order to get there, the company needs to conduct research and exploration.
Last year, we spent 6 months at sea collecting these very same rocks. We had a scientific expedition where we went out and surveyed the area extensively.
Gerard Barron says scientists returned to the zone last month to study the impact.
This visit Campaign 8, as we know it, it is about our 20th campaign, is all about looking at how the area is recovering 12 months after we were collecting rocks from our license area.
But it wasn't all smooth sailing. Midway through the expedition, Greenpeace activists arrived.
At first it was peaceful. They were in kayaks, you know, holding up signs, and that's fine. But then they started to really interfere with us being able to launch our scientific equipment into the water. And then eventually they boarded the vessel and sat on top of our A-frame, which meant that we couldn't safely operate it. So it brought the science to a grinding halt.
Last week, the metals company took legal action against Greenpeace, seeking an injunction to stop the protest. The case was heard in the District Court of Amsterdam, where the Greenpeace boat is registered.
And we were happy to see that the court did order them off the vessel.
Gerard Barron says the behaviour was reckless and dangerous.
At a time when the world is saying we need more science, we had Greenpeace turn up and do everything they could to prevent us collecting that data.
But it wasn't a complete success for the metals company. It wanted the protesters banned from going within 500 metres of their research ship, but the court refused, allowing activists to remain close by. Protesters held up signs saying, "Legally, still here." Greenpeace campaigner Louisa Casson says the court's ruling was an own goal for the mining company.
While our climbers, who had scaled the crane of the ship, had to come down, the protest continued, and it was actually a landmark ruling in support of peaceful protest, recognising the huge social importance of this issue of deep sea mining.
The activist group believes deep sea mining risks irreparably harming the ocean environment.
Greenpeace really wanted to shine a light on this. You know, we know this is hugely controversial, not just to us, but to fishing communities, to human rights groups, to a growing number of governments, nearly 25 governments who are calling for a halt on this industry.
Louisa Casson believes the protest was a huge success.
I think it really showed that just two kayaks, three boats, five climbers can really rock this industry to the core. It really showed the fragility of this industry.
But the metals company CEO, Gerard Barron, doesn't see it that way.
In their dreams. I mean, it was a nuisance. And I guess what it did do is give everyone a little bit of a wake-up call to just how far some of these very radical organisations will go.
For now, the Greenpeace ship has left the area and is on its way back to New Mexico. And although the clash may have simmered down for now, neither party is giving up on its fight.
We've got a very dedicated team of scientists on board the research vessel. They're representing many independent, world-class scientific organizations who are involved in our science research program. And all they want to do is the science.
So the momentum really continues all across the world. You know, in the last year, we have tripled the number of governments who are opposing this industry.
Marianne Farr with that report. Climate activists have praised the creation of a new loss and damage fund and the increased commitment towards renewable energy at the UN climate talks in the United Arab Emirates. But despite these gains, there's concerns around progress in reducing carbon emissions. One of the leading Pacific voices at COP28 in Dubai was the Prime Minister of Tonga, COC Sovoleni, who says it was one of the most productive climate conferences he's attended.
Basically, because we translated some of the plans into action and secured some resources.
What are some of those resources that you were able to secure?
On the Coalition for Prosperity, we managed to actually get about $225 million. That's 100 million from peso fund and about 125 from the CHEF facilities. And basically, this is about, you know, effectively managing the oceans in the Pacific, that is, and protecting about 30% of that. And also looking at healthy, productive people, especially looking at the food system that we have, which relied a lot on the ocean. And lastly, a fit-for-purpose financing, looking at sustainable mechanism to support the Blue Pacific strategy. Yeah. At the same time, we highlighted the resilient facility that we have, which is we currently have like 50 million for that one. which is basically to look at the adaptive measures that Pacific Islands would like to actually put in place. But we are hoping to actually have more donation into this particular fund, which we are aiming to operationalize by the Tonga Forum meeting in late August.
Besides, the loss and damage fund, it was actually signed off on the first day of talks. Was that actually a good thing for the Pacific?
Great thing for the Pacific. I mean, people are talking about the climate effects, but we're already experiencing it in the Pacific. We have, cyclones that are more, I mean, in a few years back, we have huge cyclones after every 10 years. But recently, we have in Category 4, Category 5 cyclones in the Pacific every second or third year. So sea level rising forces some of the villages to move inland. So the loss and damage facility can actually help rebuild some of the damages due to the climate change effect.
And when now we can come back to that Blue Pacific Prosperity Initiative. Again, it's secured already $225 million in donations from private partners. What then would be the main aim of this initiative, though?
Well, basically, I mean, to operationalize it, looking at the governance, looking at the operation eligibility conditions and the processes by the PIFS meeting or the Pacific Leaders meeting come August, end of August next year. But the main thing is to actually educate our population about how do we sustainably manage our ocean and actually promoting, say, SMAs and what have you to actually reach the 30% target that we have under this initiative. One of the other, important recognition is the fit for purpose financing, and that basically need a whole range of partners, not just private sectors, NGOs, but looking for others who actually have an interest in maintaining and sustaining a healthy ocean.
Tonga's Prime Minister Siosi Sovaleni speaking there to the ABC's Agnes Tipou. An alarming increase in new HIV infections in Papua New Guinea has people scrambling to resuscitate dormant programs to prevent the spread of the disease. After the country successfully contained what some feared would be a catastrophic epidemic of the human immune deficiency virus in the 2000s, the number of new infections has nearly doubled in just 1 year.
Tony Lupiwa, the acting director of the National AIDS Council Secretariat, is worried, very worried.
It's very alarming for us. We were expecting a small increase, but this big increase is making us panic a bit because that's a lot within 1 year space.
The big increase he's referring to is the number of new HIV infections recorded last year compared to 2021.
It has climbed up to 6,500 new cases for 2022. And that's an increase from 3,400 cases.
That works out to be 18 people testing positive to HIV per day last year, compared to just 10 new infections a day the year before. That's nearly a doubling of the rate of new infections in just a year. As alarming as that is, Dr. Anne Clark from the group Businesses for Health says the picture is even worse when you go back further and look at other statistics.
For example, if we go back to 2018, more than 500,000 tests were conducted. Last year, only 100,000 tests were conducted. You've got a catastrophic drop-off in the number of people being tested. What we've seen is an increase in the number of babies being born and diagnosed with HIV because less than a fifth of all mothers are offered an HIV test prior to birth. So we had 820 babies diagnosed with HIV last year.
So what's behind the dramatic increases? Tony Lupiwa from the National AIDS Council Secretariat says the push to prevent the spread of HIV has collapsed in recent years.
We haven't been doing prevention work in terms of awareness, advocacy and distribution of condoms and other material for people to use to protect themselves.
Where once HIV was a major public health issue in PNG, Mr. Lupiwa says it has all but disappeared from the national consciousness.
There hasn't been very much in the newspapers in the last 4 years, and the radio and TV. So maybe people thought that HIV is gone and they've gone back to the risky behaviour.
And what's the reason for that? Money, or rather, the lack of it.
It's been a tough 4 years for us because there hasn't been enough funding to cater for prevention work around the country.
And is that because of COVID, that attention was shifted that way and also resources were shifted towards COVID?
Yeah, COVID got all the attention in the last 2 years. So that's one of the reasons why the resources and attention was to COVID and not to HIV.
Dr. Anne Clark puts it a little more bluntly.
In 2010, when we thought we were at the peak of the HIV crisis in PNG, where we saw better access to testing and treatment, we went, oh, that's cool. And the rest of the wealthy world went, oh, they've got testing, they've got treatment. She'll be right, mate. COVID just put another nail in the coffin.
The result, she says, has been the total devastation of HIV prevention efforts in PNG. Mr. Lupiwa, though, is hopeful the situation can be turned around.
Both the Health Department and the National AIDS Council have been working on the new strategy, and we are going to launch it in the beginning of next year. The priority is prevention. We are hoping that the government and our donor and development partners will support us in implementing that strategy.
Dr. Clark says it's time local authorities and international donors took a more holistic approach to health development.
When donor funding comes in, quite often it's put in a bucket for that and a bucket for this. We need to get cleverer about something as basic as safe sex should be absolutely part of primary school, high school, university, workplace programming, where people can talk confidently and comfortably about their rights to sexual health.
Dr. Anne Clark from Business for Health. There's been a renewed call from Fiji's Finance and Deputy Prime Minister Biman Prasad for a visa-free Pacific. Speaking at the Australasian Aid and International Development Conference in Canberra, Professor Prasad also stressed the need for development in the Pacific to be decolonised. He told delegates that colonial concepts cannot be allowed to wear out their welcome in international development in a region that's brimming with capacity, skills and talent.
The era where the knowledge was seated in rich and industrial countries to be shared with poor developing countries has long gone. And let's keep that era buried. It nevertheless sometimes amazes me what we continue to allow colonial concepts to wear out the welcome in international development. Maybe a bit harsh, Stephen. When the ADB and the World Bank and its partners use the term capacity building, you know, I think about it seriously. As a finance minister, I can tell you that I meet development partners throughout the day. I may start my day by meeting the EU, for example, which may be proposing a program to build our capacity in agriculture. Then I may meet the World Bank, which may be saying we lack public finance management capacity. Then I may meet the US, who may tell me that our private sector lacks capacity. And this goes on and on every day. So by the end of the day, it kind of leaves me thinking about how we function as a country. If we lack capacity across so many areas.
Professor Prasad went on to say that Pacific leaders are united in their belief that the time has come to establish a fully integrated region that would include New Zealand and Australia. He has encouraged Australia to give due consideration to the benefits of a visa-free Pacific, which he said would be substantial for everyone's economies, societies and peoples.
My message to Australia is to purposefully consider becoming part of a fully integrated Pacific. Australian businesses, its entrepreneurs, students, holy men and women, skilled workers, professionals, and Australian families should be able to freely move and work across the vast blue Pacific. So should Pacific Islanders, all Pacific Islanders, not some Pacific Islanders. And as they do, they will create new opportunities across our region. And taken from the world of trade agreements, this would actually look like a Pacific Most Favored Nation partnership or agreement. A Most Favored Nation partnership would extend reciprocal privileges, including on all visa categories, and confirm a shared commitment by all countries to protect citizens, families and businesses from Australia and from the Pacific, in Australia and across the region. This is pragmatic, this is doable, and its time has come.
Professor Biman Prasad, Fiji's Finance and Deputy Prime Minister, addressing the Australasian Aid and International Development Conference in Canberra. The lawyer who blew the whistle on Papua New Guinea's biggest corruption scandal has been awarded a prestigious free speech prize. Former Solicitor General Neville Devete is among the latest recipients of the whistleblowing prize from the organisation Blueprint for Free Speech. As Liam Fox reports, Mr. Devete has been recognised for not looking the other way when he saw corruption.
Neville Devete says he was shocked by the news. His actions had earned him an international award for whistleblowers.
I am indeed astounded, and for want of a better word, I'm still shell-shocked about the news of having to be awarded.
Though he was initially unsure he would accept it.
When I was first informed by Blueprint for Free Speech, I really didn't want to accept the award, as I was only doing my job back then.
Back then was 2012, and Mr. Devete's job was Papua New Guinea's Solicitor General. That was when he told police that massive amounts of state money were being paid to one of the country's biggest law firms, Paul Peraka Lawyers, for no legitimate reason. Fast forward to this year, and the law firm's principal, Paul Peraka, was found guilty of misappropriating 162 million kina of public funds. That's the equivalent of 70 million Australian dollars. In the end, Mr. Devete did accept the award from Blueprint for Free Speech on behalf of the people of PNG.
It's not only about me or myself or my family, but it is about the people of Papua New Guinea. So if I am accepting this award, I am accepting it simply on behalf of the 10 million people of Papua New Guinea.
He says he's just doing the duty of his job, and that's true, but there are a lot of people who see serious wrongdoing like he did and don't speak up.
Soulette Dreyfus is the executive director of Blueprint for Free Speech and a member of its panel of judges. She says Mr. Devete's courage deserves to be recognised.
He didn't look the other way when he saw corruption. Instead, he raised concerns in the public interest with investigators who could act on it. And it was big corruption, $70 million, you know, in public money that mysteriously disappeared.
Mr. Devete paid a high price for his courage. He left his job and moved to Australia with his family in 2013 after they started receiving threats. But he has no regrets and hopes the Whistleblower Award will encourage others to stand up to corruption.
I see this as an opportunity to fortify or galvanize our overall resolve and courage to collectively fight corruption.
Other recipients of Blueprint for Free Speech's whistleblowing prize this year are a Norwegian Tesla worker who exposed alleged malpractice at the electric car maker, and a group of UK doctors who raised concerns about a nurse later found to have murdered seven babies. Dr. Dreyfus says whistleblowers provide an important but undervalued public service.
And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening. And do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.